Thank you so much for listening to this pre-recorded episode of Pub Talk Live. To find out more about the show and find out how you can watch live, go to pubtalk.live. Thank you so much to my Patreon podcast sponsors, Brenda Drake, Jay Lynn, and Reframe. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the August 8th episode of Pub Talk Live, the live publishing talk show airing the second and fourth Saturday of every month at 9 p.m. Eastern. I am your host, Sarah Nicholas. I'm a YA author, a board member and agent liaison for Pitch Wars, and a library event planner. You can subscribe to reminders via email by clicking on the link in the description so you don't miss a show. You can also follow the show on Twitter and Instagram at Pub Talk Live. And if you'd like to support the show, you can find a link to the Patreon near the end of the video description down below. So I'm going to go ahead and bring on today's guest co-host. Amparo Ortiz was born in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and currently lives on the island's northeastern coast. Her short story comic, What Remains in the Dark, appears in the Eisner Award-winning Puerto Rico Strong, and Saving Chupi, her middle grade graphic novel, comes out with HarperCollins in winter 2022. She holds an MA in English and a BA in psychology from University of Puerto Rico's Rio Piedras campus. When she's not teaching ESL to her college students, she's teaching herself Korean, devouring as much young adult fiction as she can and writing about Latinx characters in worlds both contemporary and fantastical. Her debut novel, which we'll talk about in a little bit, Blaze Wrath Games, hit shelves on October 6th. So please welcome to the show, Amparo. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, good. How are you? Thank you so much for coming on today.
Of course. Thank you for inviting me. I'm having a blast already.
That's good. I saw Jessica says she likes my glasses. It's funny because I actually chose these today for this because...
So I'm special?
Yes, I chose them for you.
Awesome. Thank you. Oh my God, I'm so honored.
Yeah. Let's see. Victoria's here. Hey, Victoria. And hey, Lodestar. Glad Lodestar often can't join us live, so I'm glad he's able to be here live today.
Nice.
All right. So we have the viewer poll today. Don't forget to go vote in it if you haven't already. I'm going to drop the link in the comments or in the chat. And the question is, how many genres do you read? Easy. not so easy, though. We're also joined today by Amparo's neighboring crickets.
Yes, I have a lot of crickets around. I would like to apologize.
That's fine. When it first happened, I was like, what is that? Is that your mic? And you're like, no, it's crickets. I was like, oh,
crickets,
yeah.
Like literally right next to me, yeah.
That makes sense. All right, so we're going to talk about your debut book in a little bit when we bring Ashley on. So we'll just go ahead and jump into news right now, and you have the first piece of news for us.
Yes. Authors for Black Voices is an online silent auction to raise money for racial justice, nonprofits in publishing, education, and literacy. Items include annotated copies of books, critiques from award-winning authors, and publishing consultations.
Yeah. So I first became aware of this because Kelly Garrett, who is a friend of mine, posted that she had donated kind of a consultation, I think a plotting consultation.
Awesome.
And so if nothing else, go bid on that because I'm sure that's going to be amazing if you're a writer, you know?
Yeah, I saw that a lot of people were offering books mainly, but I love that there's critique involved because that's obviously you're doing something great for a specific community that needs help, but you're also furthering your own career at the same time.
Yeah.
It's like really clever.
Yeah, and there are some annotated copies too, which are like, so, like, publishers will sell an annotated copy for, like, a super popular book. But these are ones that are, like, personally annotated by the author. Right. So, that's really cool.
And I think they don't do that often, these specific authors. Like, they don't annotate.
Yeah. So it's a lot of work.
A lot of work. Like, I think also, like, you have to take in, like, consider handwriting. I don't have the best handwriting, so.
Me neither.
That sounds like a nightmare for me personally.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, you can go check out the link. Actually, I'm going to go ahead and drop the link in the chat right now as well. But usually what we do for those of you who are watching for the first time is after the show ends, after the show goes live or and whatever, after the show broadcast ends, there we go. I drop all the links for all the news items that we're talking about in the comments so you can find them. So if you are watching a replay, they're already there. But if you're watching live, they'll be there in a minute. But I went ahead and dropped it in the comments too, if you want to check that out. All right. Next item, the Booker Prize long list was announced last week and caused quite a stir because 9 of the 13 finalists are authors who live in the United States. The Booker Prize is open to English language books published in the UK or Ireland.
And it's also interesting because most of them are debuts, which I think was also like a hot topic. Regarding this, I'm like 9 out of all of them are from the U.S. And I feel like people are very excited about that because, well, you know, relatable content. But also a lot of them, or a few of them, I should say, are people of color. So I feel like that's really nice.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I know this was a big conversation, especially because the Booker Prize, which was formerly the Man Booker Prize, was so often thought of as like the quintessential like British literature prize, and now the majority of finalists are American.
They're not British at all.
I don't know how the British literature community feels about it, but I imagine not great.
A little bitter, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess it's great, but
the Man Booker books are never books that I'm like really, honestly, all that interested in. It's just not my thing. But same. For the people who are into that, like, go for it.
Yeah, go wild. Okay, so next item. Right. Stephanie Meyer, or Mayer, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right after all these years. Stephanie Meyer announced her plans for the Midnight Sun book tour. She will be partnering with bookstores and drive-in movie theaters to hold drive-in Q&A events. So this is interesting because I feel like if it's not the first, it's one of the first socially distant book launches. And it's interesting that it's for this specific author and this specific property, because we know that a lot of people are gonna attend. I think yesterday's event was completely sold out. Tonight's event, I think, is sold out. Like, a lot of people are gonna attend. And I think it's clever that they're like including in the package the face masks, like Midnight Sun face masks.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, that's quite the marketing tool. But yeah, I think it's risky, but I hope it pans out for her and no one, you know, like everyone has fun, safety is included, and everyone's good, but
yeah.
I don't know, it's weird.
Yeah, I've seen a couple announcements about like book tours, you know, since this all started, but this was the first one that really caught my eye because they're using the drive-in movie theaters, because a lot of them are just like, we have a large space and we're just going to put less people in it and that's their solution. Right. But this is like a whole different level, I feel like.
Yeah. And
they're
actually
yeah.
Which everyone who has any interest in Midnight Sun has already seen. So it's like they're paying to watch a movie they've already seen. They probably own. So it's like part of that is going to be the movie. But okay.
Yeah. And Stephanie Meyer has the audience, has the clout to make something like this successful too. Whereas if you did it with like a debut author or something, it would be like, well, we don't know if this is going to work. So I think it's interesting that they did it with her, because then they can kind of like, they can be like, okay, this works. This is how we do it. We know this is going to work. As long as we can sell the tickets, basically. So I just, as an event planner, like I think about it from that aspect, and that you don't have to worry about the audience. So you can worry about everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think people were buying the package just because of the items. They had no interest in actually going to the movie theater.
Really?
They just wanted like the book, the signed book plates, they wanted a mask, and that was it. Like, they That's were not funny. Going to see Stephanie Meyer or like watch the movie, which is interesting.
Oh.
They still pay money, but they have like the space available for more people.
Okay. All right. That's interesting. Yeah, it's been interesting to see the dialogue this week about this book coming out because obviously it's like a cultural juggernaut. And but then there's also like so many different problematic aspects to it. And how do you balance that, especially if you're a fan who has matured in that time, but you still want to be a fan, but you also have to be aware of like the other things, you know?
Right. So it's just I did grow up loving the story, but not for like the romance aspect of it. I loved other things about it, but you have to admit to yourself that it's super flawed and quite problematic, as you say. So I feel like people who are real fans will acknowledge it, and people who are just interested in other things and are quite selfish about those interests will not acknowledge those things.
Yeah.
Which is problematic in itself. It's quite common.
Yeah, it's like, you know, it's the quintessential problematic fave, right?
Yes. But again, some people are just interested in like seeing the hot guy, quotation marks, question mark at the end, the hot guy's perspective. So
yeah. So but I hope everyone who's excited about it gets what they want from the book. This has been a really long, weird journey for this book.
Yeah.
All right. So, Tamara's here. Hey, Tamara. Welcome. What time is it where you are? Is it like 9 in the morning there? Tamara's from Australia. Oh, yeah.
That's very nice of her to tune in.
Yeah. Newbery Honor recipient, 2-time National Book Award finalist, and 2020 and 2021 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature, Jason Reynolds, has sold his first debut novel to Simon & Schuster. First adult, sorry, debut novel to Simon & Schuster. It's titled The Mouthless God and Jesus Number 2 and will come out in 2022.
I'm super excited. Like, I love Jason.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it was a matter of time for him to go into the adult market, but it still shocked me because I'm so used to him in the kidlit sphere. But I think this book is going to be quite amazing, as his past work is.
Yeah, I definitely think I was not surprised at all to see it, but it's also so weird because we think of him as like this great children's author, which he is. But also, like, I mean, if you hear him talk about literature for an adult audience, he talks. I mean, it's not surprising at all. You know, he right. speaks like any poet or literary fiction author. In terms of like the books that he talks about and the themes that he talks about and stuff like that. So, yeah, I'm not surprised at all. It's exciting. I don't know what it's going to be like. I can't wait to check it out. 2022, it's a long ways away though.
It's so long, but I think it'll be worth the wait, and he's going to just blow everyone's minds as he often tends to do so.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
We are fans. Oh, sorry. I was going to say, we are fans of Jason Reynolds on Pub Talk Live.
We are.
So.
Yes.
Go ahead.
All right. So the American Library Association announced that its midwinter meeting scheduled for January will be replaced by a digital event. I feel like this is the norm now. Like, we are going to see this happen. God knows when. I have no idea when this is going to actually end, the pandemic, I mean. So I feel like it's a preventative measure because this is like January. And I feel like that was supposed to be the last one. They weren't supposed to like do more, but they announced like tentative schedules for 2 more years after.
Mm-hmm.
And that's quite ambitious as well, but it's better for people who do not live near where the conference takes place.
They had 10,000 attendees to their summer one. Their summer one went digital as well, but it's also like, as an event planner, it's such a weird time right now. I know a friend, sometimes she's here, I don't know if Jen's here tonight, she plans a conference in February every year, and Oh, yeah. Sorry. Oh, Lodestar, you came a couple minutes late. Yeah. And Paro has little crickets.
Yes.
So that's what you're hearing. what was I saying? So a conference in February. And so she had to make the decision actually a couple of months ago whether or not she was going to go digital or not.
Yeah.
And then it's like, it's such a gamble right now to book anything in person because all the contracts and like, who knows if they'll give you a refund on your contracts or anything. And that was the issue, is like a lot of people aren't able to get the venues to give them any kind of like compensation, you know, if they right. have to cancel.
Yeah, I think that's the most important factor to take in, because you can change the event in your head. You're like, oh, well, this date doesn't work anymore, then let's move it to this next date. But in terms of logistics, it's so hard to get people on board with helping you change something from happening. Instead of one day, it's this long year later or year after mm-hmm. the date you had planned. So I feel like it's just better to stay remote, but it is sad at the same time for several yeah. reasons, especially if people are like looking forward to going for the first time and this is the, you know, their experience is not going to be what they had in mind, but at the same time they will still be alive. So
yes, yeah, especially like I can see Ashley, I know no one else can, but she has a kitten in her lap right now.
just distracted me.
Maybe it'll hang around for when we bring her on.
Yay!
Yeah, it's a tough time right now, especially like the conference I was referring to earlier is very much like one of those conferences where it feels like a family reunion every year. Like you're getting to right. see, you know, the people that you love every year. And now it's like, well, we won't be having those like 2 a.m. like hallway conversations, you know?
Right. And that sense mm-hmm. of community is, you know, important for a lot of people because they feel mm-hmm. like they're being heard, they're seen, their like-minded peers are there with them, like face-to-face, and now it's a little bit different, but yeah, it has to suck for a lot of people.
Victoria is going to BoucherCon virtually. Interesting.
Oh,
yeah.
Nice.
Cool. I went a couple years ago when it was in Tampa. That's one that moves around every year. And it was in Tampa and they gave me like a media discount. So,
nice.
Yeah. So I was like, I'll go, you know, it was fun.
Well.
I mean, I had fun. Yeah. All right. Our last piece of publishing news, serialized fiction app Radish has secured $63 million in new funding to expand. They currently offer romance and some speculative fiction, but plan to expand into young adult horror, mystery, and LGBTQ stories.
Have you used this app?
I have not used it, but I actually have talked to some of their reps. They came to a conference that I was at back when they were kind of like first launching. They were actively pursuing romance authors to sign up to do stories on the app. So it's a micro transaction app. So basically you pay per chapter, essentially. They call them episodes, but they're basically chapters, and you can pay, it's usually like less than a dollar to read a chapter.
Right. It's like similar to webtoons, maybe. I'm more familiar, sorry, with webtoons.
Yeah.
So I feel like it might be similar, but yeah, charging by the chapter is quite common.
Yeah. So it's like, they'll usually give you like the first one, you know, for free to hook you.
Yeah. Like, look how awesome this is. No, pay for more. Yeah.
But one thing I did. Yeah, I haven't used it. But one thing that I did notice from the article that I thought was really funny is they have a lot of soap opera author or writers on the app.
And like the pictures themselves or the images of like each title are very soap opera-ish.
Yeah.
So it's on brand. It's definitely on brand.
Yeah. And if you want people to like keep, you know, coming back, soap opera writers are definitely pros at that.
Those are the ones.
Those so dramatic cliffhangers.
Yeah. They know what they're doing.
Yeah. All right. Well, it is time to bring on our special guest. Ashley Hearn is an acquisitions editor at Peachtree Publishing. Prior to joining Peachtree, they spent 3 years at Page Street Publishing, working with authors such as Isabel Ibanez, Laurie M. Lee, Candace Montgomery, Sonia Hartle, and Addie Thorley. When Ashley steps away from their desk, they can be found sampling craft beer, armchair quarterbacking for the Green Bay Packers, or haunting a local coffee shop. So please welcome to the show, Ashley.
Woo!
Yay!
Yes,
I know. I wish I could.
He's right here. He's right here.
Oh, goodness.
Look just dropping in. Yep. I haven't even had him a week, and he just doesn't care what he's just like a floppy potato. It's the weird.
Love.
And his sister, so he adopted two kittens, a boy and then his sister. This is Beelzebub, and his sister or B or Mr. B for short. His sister is Princess Cirilla, the lion cub of Sintra.
Of course.
But she doesn't like being picked up all that much. And then there's this guy.
She's all for it. He's like, yeah.
That's so funny. Yeah, people are Lodestar said welcome. Victoria said hi, Ashley. Ooh. People are loving the cat, of course.
Yes.
Castle Books. It's the brand.
Yeah.
that was something that was funny is I got to Peachtree. I started at the end of June there, and everybody has cats.
Oh, really?
I didn't have any pets because the apartment that I lived in Massachusetts was not a pet friendly apartment. And so I had no pets. And now I have two pets. And I actually adopted these two. They were being fostered by one of our designers at Peachtree. So I think I was in a staff meeting, and I mentioned something about, or I think it was Margaret, the Peachtree CEO and the head publisher. Her cat like leaped up on the chair in the background. I was like, oh, kitties, I can't wait to get one. Like, now that I live in Georgia, I'm gonna adopt one. And then Lily, who was fostering these guys, was like, I have two that I'm trying to get rid of. It just all came to be. And now I'm a cat mom, so we're good.
And it's funny, she had told us, you know, before she went to visit, she's like, I'm going to go see these cats, but I probably won't get them. And we're like, oh, yeah, you're going to get them.
There's no way that you go. And I wasn't really originally planning on two, but after seeing the way that these two interacted with each other and doing a little research, I kind of got talked into the two, and I'm really glad that I did. So they complement each other very well. So. Yes, very soft, warm little ball of fur. It's very enhances any work from home situation for sure.
Well, this channel is no stranger to cats because we do write-ins on Wednesday, and me and my co-host, we both have cats, and then she also fosters cats. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes she'll use kittens as an incentive. She'll be like, oh, if y'all hit 7,000 words, we'll have a cat break.
We're just like show cats around.
Yeah.
Like the foster kittens. You're just like, oh, it's a little kitten.
Like a flying
All right.
Cat.
Jennifer has joined. Jennifer, I was talking about Coastal Magic earlier. We were talking about rescheduling conferences to virtual. So welcome back, Jennifer. All right. So the first question I have for you today, Ashley, is from Patreon supporter Jaylen. So if you support the Patreon, you get to submit questions ahead of time for the guests. What was your career path to becoming an editor? And then also, what advice do you have for someone seeking that same career? So it's like a two-parter.
Okay. I will try to keep it very concise because I've told this story a few times and I tend to just get blabbermouthed. I had a really untraditional path into publishing in the sense that I never moved to or lived in New York. I didn't go to school for it. I didn't go to college for it. I didn't know that publishing was a job that you could do until after I graduated. So it was writing actually that got me into publishing. I wrote fan fiction mostly in high school, and then all through college I wrote fan fiction. Everybody always asks, what did you write? It was Legend of Zelda mostly. I was like, writing this epic Legend of Zelda fan fiction. It got to be like 200,000 words. It was this monstrosity of a book. It was basically an epic fantasy, but with Zelda characters. And around my like senior year of college, I started writing my own original stories and was like, well, I should probably figure out how to get this published. So I Googled how to publish book. And then I like kind of fell down a rabbit hole of knowledge and information. I signed up to do this kind of online summer webinar course that was a grad student of Brandon Sanderson's at BYU had compiled his lectures together into a course that you could do online for free. And it was basically your like intro to sci-fi fantasy publishing class. It taught me like what critique partners are and what a query is and what agents do and what the big five publishing houses are. And along with craft things like basic plot structures and how to like write a character with agency and show don't tell, those kind of things that I didn't have because I never, like I said, I never went to college or anything for publishing. I got my degree in TV, radio, film production. So still some storytelling elements there, but not publishing track related. And so I just was like falling down this, like I said, rabbit hole of information where I just couldn't absorb info fast enough. I had a job. I was living in Madison, Wisconsin at the time. I had a job in sports production, which was my field that I had studied for. I was producing the football and men's basketball coaches TV show. It was called the Badger Sports Report. And it was a really fun seasonal job. I got to go to a lot of really cool sporting events. I like sports, so that means something to me. I had that job that I liked and paid me enough to survive in Madison, Wisconsin. And at the same time, I also, the more I worked in the field, the more I realized this isn't sports reporting, isn't what I want to be doing for the rest of my life. It was one of those things where like I was working and I was having a great time at it, but every chance that I got, I was running home to either write or work on a critique partner's things or doing something publishing related at every chance that I could get. And it all kind of came to a head in, I guess this was 2014 or so. I had a job offer from ESPN to be a production assistant at ESPN. And if you know anything about sports, ESPN is like the big like player in sports production. So this was like kind of your foot in the door to bigger things in the sports industry if you want to go that route. And so I went out there and I did this whole round table full of interviews and I ended up getting the job. And when I got the job offer, my first thought was, oh, and I'm like, oh, that's not a good sign. And because the whole time I had been out there doing these interviews, I kind of just became more and more like disillusioned. Like, I don't want to, like, these people don't look happy. I don't think I would be happy here. Like, I don't want to work 60 hours a week and not have any time for writing, which was my hobby at the time. I was like, I really do want to have the room in my life for that. And this isn't that. And so I turned the job down. I think I might be the only person to ever turn that job down because I definitely, there were some jaws on floors at the time. And so I turned that down and it was kind of with the understanding that, okay, like if you're not going to take this job, that's not what you want to do, then you need to find something else. And I've always been the kind of person that I've always wanted to find a job that doesn't feel like a job to me. And so the fact that every spare moment I had was dedicated to publishing in some capacity at the time was a sign that actually that's where your heart lies. So I think it was I really, at that point, came back from that trip to Connecticut and was like, all right, like, I really want to work full time in publishing. This is what I want to do. I do want to write, but I want to work in the industry in some capacity. I wasn't sure exactly at that point whether it was as an agent or an editor or a publicist. I was still kind of learning all the different jobs and the tricks of the trade. And so I started looking for online internships. And I fortunately got one with Entangled Publishing, working for Kate Browning. And Kate was an amazing mentor. So the second part of your question was, what are some things that you can do to break into the industry? I really, really, really feel strongly that publishing is an apprenticeship-driven industry. It's something that you only get good at by doing it. And editing is a skill that you get better and better and better at the more you get your hands in manuscripts. So if you're really looking to break in, get your hands in as many manuscripts as possible. And so my early, I guess, career building things were ways that I could build up my editorial skills while also being remote, because I was in Madison at the time. The whole time I'm building up my resume, I'm still doing the Badger Sports Report because it was a flexible job. And like I said, it paid me enough to live in Wisconsin, and I didn't want to leave a job that I liked to move to New York without a job and to be in a 3 times more expensive city. So I was interning at Entangled. I had a fantastic mentor who really brought me under her wing and built up my skills. And I started working on some manuscripts there. I eventually started editing stories under her. And that was a really great way, again, to get my hands on manuscripts. And it's like one of those things that the more times that you see certain patterns and certain holes and certain weak points in manuscripts, not only does it become easier to identify them, but it becomes easier to explain why it's a weakness to the author. And that's the hardest part, I think, of writing an edit letter isn't necessarily identifying what isn't working, but being able to explain why it isn't working. And a good editor will do that. A good editor will be able to explain why it's not working. And then this is how you can achieve the manuscript's potential so that the author's not just flailing around in the darkness. it's not the most helpful thing in the world just to point out what's wrong, because then the author's like, well, what do I do about it? And if an author's asking, what do I do about it? Then as an editor, you could get back any number of things when the manuscript returns to you. So being able to identify why something isn't working and explain that to the author in a clear way, that's something that you can really only get good at by doing it over and over and over and over again. And I think it used to take me days to write one edit letter. And now, like, when I sit down to actually write the edit letter, I can get it done in like 2 days. And my edit letters tend to be a little bit more on the lengthy side of Morrow. A little bit. So along with interning at Entangled, I also got involved in Pitch Wars. And that was just, again, it was another way that I could get my hands in manuscripts. And why I really wanted to work with Pitch Wars was the chance to get to edit more books. And B, because I know the talent that comes through that competition. Some of the best talent that is going to be published in the future comes through that door. And I really wanted to work with some of that best and brightest up and coming talent. I really wanted the chance to get to work with somebody that I felt had a book that could change the world. And I feel like Pitch Wars sees those manuscripts. So I kind of cozied up to Brenda at RT in Vegas, which is also where I met Sarah. Hey, I can mentor. And Brenda didn't think I was weird, so she let me. And at the time, I was also freelance editing. So again, another way to get my hands in manuscripts. So there was a point about 2 years there where I was interning at Entangled, freelance editing, and doing Pitch Wars,
along with a couple of paid jobs that I had going on in the background. So it was, there was a lot happening there. I was working 4 to 5 jobs for about 3 years, just piecing together resume things and money where I could. And out of that, I eventually just had some solid credentials. So in Pitch Wars, my mentees had a lot of success. And then in freelance editing, I worked with some clients that signed with publishers and agents. And all of those things are things that you can put on a resume. So it's not just saying, oh, I freelance edit. It's saying, oh, I freelance edit and I worked on this book that sold to this agent that sold to this publishing house. Or it's like, no, I didn't just do Pitch Wars. I worked with Tomi Adeyemi and her book sold to this agent, this publisher for this much money. Mm-hmm. And so those concrete things, you really want to flush your resume out with those. So I always tell my interns, remember what books you worked on. So when I work with interns, I have them work on books that are actually getting published. I'm like, okay, this book was put on a ALA list for this. It got a Kirkus Starred review. Those are things that interns should be documenting. So a book that sells X number of copies first year. Those are things that you should be putting in your resume. So remote internships are really, really useful. This is one of the good things, I hate to say that, to come out of COVID is a lot of more paid online internships. I have found, I think I've recommended 5 or 6 different paid remote internships to people looking just within the last couple of weeks alone. These have been rare opportunities in the past. And so that's something that I hope will continue to happen even after there's a vaccine and we can sort of get back to a semi-normalcy. I hope that that's something that doesn't go away, because I would not have had the opportunities that I've had if it weren't for remote internships. It's a lot to ask somebody to pick up and move to New York on with no job.
Yeah. Or even a job that pays $28,000 a year. Like,
I can't imagine living in New York on $28,000 a year.
Yeah. Hopefully that we see that improve as well. We talked a lot about that when I had SJ Jones and Patrice Caldwell on the show. We talked a lot about publishing entry salaries. All right. So I'm going to go ahead and ask my next question, Amparo, because I'm just a little concerned about time, but we'll see. We might come back to it. And also Ashley touched on it a little bit. But so Ashley, you acquired Amparo's Blaze Wrath Games book, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you edited on it.
Yes.
And you mentioned on Twitter that there was a wild ride involved with the publication of this book. Do you want to share some of that story?
I mean, it was just kind of a more non-traditional way in which I found the book, or that it came to my attention.
Weird, unusual, perfect.
Yeah, it was perfect. Natalie C. Parker, the YA author, had organized these agented writer meetup groups, and Amparo and I were put in the same group, and these were like Facebook groups that were meeting at the time, and so we were in this private Facebook group together, and she was just talking about this like dragons fantasy manuscript, and I had on my wish list a dragon fantasy manuscript because I love sports so much. I wanted a like fantasy sports book, like something that took sports and then put them in like either a sci-fi or fantasy setting. And so I was like, oh my god, this book is perfect. And so I just kind of rooted her on as she was writing it, and then I beta read it as just a beta reader when it was in its more infant stages, and and I loved it then. And I knew that I wanted to see it eventually. I don't think at that point, I don't think I was even working at Page Street. I think it was.
Oh, yes, you were.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I would have been like right, like when I was really early there.
Starting out.
And lo and behold, a couple years later, her agent sent it to me and I was like, off to Athens we go. So yeah,
yeah,
it didn't just come to me through the slush in the traditional sense. It was, we had a prior connection, so.
Wow. All right. And Pro, do you want to just tell us real quick, like, do you have like a short, you know, pitch for the book you want to share with everyone?
Yeah, I mean,
no,
it's pretty much the World Cup with dragons, and Puerto Rican athlete is trying to represent her country. She's trying to reconnect with her Puerto Rican roots and reclaiming the identity that she feels she lost. But not only does she want glory, she wants to win. She just wants to excel at being an athlete. She's also dealing with a murderous cursed dragon who wants the cup canceled and therefore wants to ruin her life.
All right. Cool. And that comes out in
conspiracy.
Yes, yes. It's October 6th.
Yeah. Cool. All right. Cool. Perfect. Okay. So yeah, if you want to go ahead and go move on to your next question.
Okay. So how would you define your personal editing style?
My personal editing style is really collaborative. And I always say that both at the editing phase and then all the way through to publication, I really do care about fostering relationships. And I see everything as a conversation. When it comes to edits, I always say that nothing is a mandate, that these are all, I tend to overuse the phrase springboard for your own ideas. I think like every edit letter I've ever written is always said, these are just springboards for your own ideas. So yeah, when it comes to edit letters, I tend to write these longer-ish ideas with the that should be getting authors thinking, and then if there's any questions, we just go back and forth, and I want authors to feel comfortable with what they're doing, but then that collaboration moves on to the production side of things as well. Like, I like my authors to be involved in interior design and cover design, and I want them to be able to ask me questions when it comes to marketing and publicity. I feel very strongly that there shouldn't be secrets kept between a publisher and an author, because it's the author's career first and foremost. And so transparency is key. So there's never anything that an author could ask me that I imagine I would say. If they want to see their sales figures, I will let them know their sales figures. If they want to know their buy-in numbers, I will let them know their buy-in numbers. Because those are things that authors need to know in order to know what they need to be doing more of, less of, if it's a sign that they're doing something right or need inspiration. There's nothing that an author, there's no information that I think a publisher should be keeping from its authors. And so I do try to be that person that facilitates that comfort between the author and the publisher, because the publisher can be this big, scary entity. And the editor should be that like cheerleader and champion within the house. And I do try to be that person that authors can trust coming to me to get them the information that's going to help their career the best. I also am a very just enthusiastic editor. I believe that it's the editor's number one job to edit the book, but maybe even more important to be the champion for the book. So when people talk about how, like an editor or agent passed for subjective reasons because they just weren't feeling enthusiastic enough or they didn't get that must be mine feeling about the book. That's a very real, valid thing, because an editor's enthusiasm for the project is directly correlated with how well that project's going to do in the future, because it's the editor's job to be the person that is pushing the book in-house. So a book that an editor is extremely enthusiastic about, they're going to be able to go to the sales team and put their cheerleading pom-poms on and get the sales team excited. And the sales team's going to be able to go to their indie buyers and get the indie buyers excited. So an editor's enthusiasm can be infectious. And if that enthusiasm isn't 110% there, then it's not the right project for that editor or that imprint or house. So being very enthusiastic, being very vocal about my projects, both online and behind the scenes, and doing anything that I can to support my titles, those are, I would say, keys to my style, along with just the editing part.
I concur.
It's you're like, I know this. I've been through it.
I can vouch for all of it.
I'm glad I'm not lying, Mara. Yes.
And it is important to note that, Ashley used cheerleading metaphors quite a few times in that. And Ashley was an actual cheerleader as well.
Makes sense.
I was.
That's great. Yeah, one of the characters in the book I'm working on is a cheerleader, and Ashley's like, "Oh, if you need any cheerleading stuff, I got you."
I think I have like jazz hands at least 3 or 4 times in the conversation, so you can just cancel me right now.
Never.
Great. All right, so we have another question.
My siblings are watching, and they all get to cancel me for the jazz hands. I am positive.
So we have another question from Patreon supporter Lodestar this time. When mentoring a book so immersed with minority inspired culture, I think this is a reference mainly to Tomi, how did you help guide and shape the world building of the in-book universe, and any tips for others trying to do the same?
I didn't actually push the world building in that story all that much. We were more focused on plot and pacing. And the world building that we did focus on was nothing in terms of her ideas. So it was all about more execution related things. So I mean, in general, I'm very rarely gonna edit an author's idea. If I were to feel like I'm supposed to be editing their idea, I'm probably not the right fit for the project. So with Children of Blood and Bone specifically, the world building editing that we did do was to make some things more cohesive and to push certain elements. But nothing that was substantial. There is a cat meowing in the background. The one on my lap really wants to get down. And even like with Blaze Wrath Games, I don't think we didn't really edit the ideas, and like the world building didn't change all that much. If anything, it was just, again, to make things cohesive or to simplify some things here and there, but it was more a craft approach than an idea-based approach.
Totally. Right. And I think it's just like a credit to you that this book makes sense. Like, the plot was kind of yay, and then you were like, no.
I would say the plot has tended to be my strong suit, and that was one of the things that excited me about Blaze Wrath Games, is Amparo's imagination is just uncanny. And so it took like my editorial strong suit in being able to wrangle plot together and put it together with somebody who just has these outstanding characters and ideas. That's a marriage that I like to work with a lot, because it's like best of everybody's worlds. And then I think the books turn out really well in that sense.
Great.
100%.
Amparo, you want to go ahead?
Yes. What's a common misconception about editors you wish to clarify?
Common misconception about editors. I guess one would be that we want to change your book. I don't think that's the case. Again, like if it's an idea that I'm not clicking with, then I'm not the right editor for the concept. I do tend to say that the two things that I don't tend to edit are concept and voice, because those are really subjective things. And if a concept and voice aren't clicking with me, then it's not the right project for me. I don't think that there are any editors that want to just change your book. And I do think that that's, again, why it's so important for editors to explain why they're suggesting a certain edit, because the better you explain the why, the more it makes sense to the author and the more receptive they are to certain changes. I've never worked with any authors that pushed back against edits. I mean, maybe just a few small things here or there, or they had different ideas, but they had different creative solutions, but still were addressing a problem or a hole that was there. I don't think editors are out to change your books. They're just there to help you. I always say they want you to help you achieve your best vision for your book.
I do remember one particular edit. The second book I had with Entangled was with Stacey. Stacey was my editor. And there was something she was like, I don't like this part. She didn't say it that bluntly, but I don't like this part. I think you should do this instead. And I was like, it didn't feel like something that my character would do. It didn't seem like it would be true to my character. And so I was able to think about it for a while and be like, I see where the problem is, but what if we do this, which was a totally different thing to solve that same problem. And a lot of authors, I think, who haven't been through the editing process don't realize that it's a conversation. It's not an edit.
Yeah.
You know,
it's kind of like the same thing that with agents, if you're afraid to ask your to go to your editor and confide in your editor and have these conversations with your editor, that's a symptom of a larger problem. That's a symptom of a communication error that shouldn't be there. Editors are generally really friendly people. We're in it because we love books. We're always open to conversation, at least the editors I know. So,
all right. So we have the last question, and this is my fault, 2 episodes in a row. So usually I like to give a little bit of a heads up on this question before we go live, but we were just chatting and I forgot. But that happened the last episode too with Beverly Jenkins. No. So
I'm so nervous now.
It's fine. It's not that bad. The question I ask all my guests is, what is the most important book you've ever read and why? And important being defined however you define it.
I kind of hate to use this book because it's like such an old dead white dude book. but it was important to me. Mm-hmm. As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner. Mm. I read that book junior year of high school, and I was in a very rigorous lit program. I did the IB program in high school, and it was very lit heavy. And I had a lit teacher that kicked my butt. But also, he really kicked my butt in the right like ways, because I wanted to please this guy. Like, I had to get an A. Like, I am a very competitive person, and and I was not going to satisfy for anything less than an A in this guy's class. And I was struggling because that class was one where so much American lit, so the American lit curriculum is like memorization based, it was comprehension based and not analysis based. So it's about comprehending what you read and not being able to analyze what you read. And this class wasn't about comprehension. It was all about analysis. And I was struggling to make the transition between the two until that book. And all of a sudden, it was like some light bulbs clicked. Even the first time through, I wasn't getting it. And then the second time through, all of a sudden, I realized that I was analyzing this book. and it was, it literally was like opened the floodgates, and I figured out how to do literary analysis from that point on. but I the reason why I say it was so important is because it's, I think I do literary analysis in my day job every day. Like, that's essentially what I do as an editor. And so I think that having that just moment when I was in high school, where I got so excited about like figuring out what this meant, directly led to where I am today. And so I'm very thankful that I had a high school lit program that had a teacher and a class that focused on that analysis part. Because when I, by the time I went to college, there were, I would say most of the kids I went to college with hadn't had that. And so they get thrown into college lit classes only having done literary comprehension, and are all of a sudden being able to ask to write these like long papers, like, I don't know, expanding on a metaphor of some sort and with no explanation of how to do that. So yeah, As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner was really important to me.
All right. It's funny because I don't know if you remember, like last, or I guess this February, I had that tweet go viral that's like, authors should read one book written in the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And Faulkner is always the author that's used as like the example of like, you know, what the people who don't believe in modern literature like put on a pedestal, you know what I mean?
Yeah, or like F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Yeah. Like Faulkner was mentioned so much during that conversation.
I remember that one book, because I did actually try to read some of his other books and I didn't like them as much. Oh. There were some characters in that book that I really, really fell for. I really liked Jewel and Darl, and yeah, all the whole family was just so messed up. Yeah, it's, yeah, I mean, it was important to me. Is it my favorite? Great.
I love it. Yeah. Well, that's why I don't ask that question. That's why I asked that question that way.
If you ask me to pick my favorite book, I'll just, I don't know, fling tomatoes at you or something. I know.
All right. Well, Ashley, thank you so much for joining us today. Me and Amparo have a couple things we're going to do before we close out. So you can hang out if you want, but if you need to go, you can just.
I'll go back to my backstage dancing.
Yes. Go to your backstage dancing. Yes. All right. Bye, Ashley. Thank you.
Bye.
All right. That was fun. I love chatting with Ashley.
Yes. This is pretty much the first time that I've like chatted with her face to face. I was about to say in real life, but yeah, that's not it.
Yeah. All right. So we have the audiobook of the week coming up. So this is a book. Well, I'll tell you what it is, and then I'll talk about it a little bit. So it's When the Ground is Hard by Mala Nunn, read by Bonnie Turpin. And this is the short description from the publisher. In this stunning and heartrending tale set at a Swaziland boarding school, two girls of different castes bond over a shared copy of Jane Eyre. So you know what's funny is like the book, Jane Eyre was a smaller part of the book than I thought it would be based on this short pitch, but I mean it is there, but it's just not quite as a big a portion as it makes it sound. But I always say that like sometimes I'll choose an audiobook just because I like the narrator and not necessarily because I'm interested in the book itself. And right. So this is actually one of those where that happened. And I had accepted it a while back, a couple months ago, because I was kind of interested, and I saw Bonnie Turpin was reading it. I was like, okay, I'll listen to it because I'll listen to pretty much anything Bonnie Turpin reads. And so when I started, I was like, why did I request this book? What is this? and then I heard her voice and I was like, oh, that's why. And it's also probably not a book I would have read otherwise, because it's just not right. Kind of like my normal thing. And also I'll say the main character, the way it starts out, the main character is a snob. Like, she really is. Like, the your point of view character. I mean, as obviously this is set in Swaziland, so it's like very kind of different. But she definitely looks down on the other girl who's the main character when it starts off. And I think, but that's what part of makes it so good by the end, you know? But at the beginning, you're like, man, she is not nice.
Makes it juicier, I guess.
It's, yeah,
like an episode of Gossip Girl, but like audio form.
Yeah, and it's really, it was the author is from Swaziland, grew up in Swaziland. And is also mixed race, like the main characters are. And so there's a lot of conversation about like the way that race and class comes into play and their social strata, you know. But yeah, I really, it surprised me. It snuck up on me, you know what I mean? And by the time I it was over, I was like, oh, this was really good. I really enjoyed this. So, yeah, I recommend
like,
it.
Why am I doing this? Oh, I love this. Nice. I like
it. Yeah.
That was quite the journey.
It happens sometimes. Yeah.
Yes. And we always appreciate it when it happens.
Yeah. So props to Bonnie Turbin for making me, you know, get outside my comfort zone a little bit.
Nice.
Yeah. So Bonnie Turbin has read, she read, Tomi's book. And she's read oh my gosh, The Hate You Give. She's read a lot of big books in YA. So
yeah.
She also read Kelly Garrett's series as well. All right. So it's time. Have you read any good or listened to any good audiobooks? Do you listen to audiobooks or?
I don't. I really want to get into them because I feel like they would help me read more or get to more books. Since my time is quite limited in terms of how I distribute it. But yeah, no, I listen to podcasts, so I don't think it would be like such a huge shift. Mm. But yeah, no, I don't really listen to audiobooks and I need to get my life in check.
I have this conversation a lot with people on the show because obviously I do, and that's why I included it as a segment.
Yeah.
And I love them. And I always end up having this conversation with guests because they're like, I don't. And I'm like, they feel bad. It's almost like they feel guilty. I'm like, it's fine if you don't. But yeah, I started because I had 45-minute commute both ways. So an hour and a half each day in the car. And I hated the radio. And like, I'm not that big into music. And so I struggled at first though, like because I kept getting distracted and like I would have to keep rewinding like minutes at a time because I would like kind of, you know, tune it out. And then I started listening to it at faster speed and that actually helped me focus a little bit better.
Okay.
So yeah, try that.
Yeah.
And you also kind of, I feel like you have to kind of like train your brain to focus sometimes. It doesn't, for some people, I guess it comes naturally. For some people, I think you have to do a little bit of work. It's just like reading. You have to work on your reading skills. So,
yeah.
All right. So it's time to discuss the viewer poll of the week. And I actually have it pulled up this time, ready to go. So the question was, how many genres do you read?
Interesting.
And the reason why I ask this question is in the romance community, you run into a lot of people who only read romance. They don't read anything else. Right. And then also I work at a library and we'll see people come in and they have one specific genre that they read. Right. So I kind of wanted to see like, but obviously the people who follow me on Twitter are like book people, you know?
Right.
So maybe it might be a little bit different from the normal population, but I am still, surprised to see that most people who answered, well, 36%, just listen to 2 to 3 genres.
Yeah, same. I personally did 4 or 5. Or
read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I was expecting like either pretty much all of them or 4 to 6 to like.
Yeah.
But yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, still 32% said 4 to 6.
It's pretty close.
But so that's that 4.7, that's probably 2 people then out of 85 votes that, no, that's 4 people. Yeah.
Good. Your
math is hard. It's probably about four people that listen and just or reads just one genre. So that's interesting. I read pretty much all of them, except I don't really read horror. Though I'm listening to The Year of the Witching right now, which is...
Oh, how is it? Because
it's not that scary.
Okay.
For like, I'm a huge scary wimp. Ashley's cheering.
Nice.
I think that was one of Ashley's Pitchwares mentees. Yeah.
Yes. I believe so.
Yeah. So I'm a huge scaredy cat, but like so many people were talking about it that I was like, well, I'll try it.
Okay.
But like then. I most of the time when I listen to audiobooks right now, I'm walking, so I take these walks in the evening.
Okay.
And yesterday when I went out, like no, day before, I don't remember. It was yesterday. The sky was like this weird color and all the light was like yellow, this like weird yellow, and I was like
like this is too weird. Stop listening right now.
Yeah. Nice. But yeah, so I pretty much listen to everything except horror, like hardcore horror. And I don't read or listen to a lot of literary fiction either. So but everything else game. Yeah. Yes. All right. I didn't upload the quote the book reading quote of the week overlay, so I can just read it to y'all. I don't have it to show on screen. Sorry about that. And the quote is, books can be dangerous. The best one should be labeled, this could change your life. Helen Exley.
That's very true.
Yeah. I was just like, yeah. But I like how it's like, this can be dangerous. This could change your life. And it's definitely true. I think a lot of people get have their horizons expanded through books, you know?
No, and just like finding their favorite genre, like they could perhaps like a certain genre, but then they realize, oh, that other book sounds interesting. Let me just, and so what you say is correct, because it's like, it's dangerous in the sense that you are going to challenge yourself and you are going to redefine what you like, what you don't like for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Let's see. Victoria said, thanks to the speed talk in previous episode, I am now a 1.3 listener. Nice. yeah, we had a whole conversation about that. What speed you listen to audiobooks at a couple episodes ago. So, yeah. Tamara said, oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, that's an actually bigger deal than I thought. Like the speed. I'll take that into consideration.
Yeah, I made it the poll of the week because we had actually had the conversation in the Book Riot Slack, because pretty much everyone I know who writes about audiobooks professionally listens to them quickly.
Okay.
At more than a one speed. Yeah. And so I was like, is that just us or is that kind of like a general public thing?
Nice.
Tamara said, I used to just read one genre, but now I'm up to four. I'm trying to expand what I read. Nice. And Victoria said, The Year of Witching isn't scary. I know, but I'm just such a scaredy cat. Like, I'm really bad about it. I also have Mexican Gothic on my phone, and I'm like, I need to only listen to this in the daytime because I've heard it's a little scary.
That's also waiting for me right now. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I need more time.
Yeah. I will say, by the way, for... probably in the fall, I might not have as many audiobooks of the week because I'm doing the Audies award judging again, and I'm not allowed to talk about the books I listen to, and that will take like all my listening time. So I don't know if I'll be able to have audiobook of the week very much then, but yeah, just a heads up on that. So maybe I'll make all my guests pick one.
Very good, nice strategy.
Oh, yeah,
it's you.
All right, Amparo, thank you so much for joining me tonight. This has been really fun. It's gone so fast. I felt like this was just so fast.
This is literally the fastest thing I've ever experienced in my life.
And you can find Amparo's website and social media information down below, as well as Ashley's. And so you can go check them out on social media and their websites and that kind of thing. And I'm going to say goodnight to Amparo. Just going to finish up a few things, and I'll talk to you in a minute, okay?
Yes. Good night, everyone. All right.
Bye. Thank you. All right. Yeah, I did it last year. Lodestar, I did the audio, the Audi award judging last year, and I really liked it. And this year I actually got a category that I'm even more excited about. So yay. All right. So if you enjoyed the show, don't forget to like and subscribe right down there so you don't miss another episode. Also tell your friends, because that's how they find out about shows like this. And you can subscribe to email reminders in the description. There's also the link for the Patreon in the description as well. Thank you so much to my Patreon supporters. I love seeing y'all support in the group every week, but it's really every 2 weeks, right? Because episodes are every 2 weeks. And I just really enjoy hanging out with y'all in there. So thank you so much. And the link for, like I said, our guests is in the description, all the links. And also Pub Talk Live social media is Pub Talk Live at Twitter and Instagram. Thank you so much for watching. And I'll see you next time. Stay safe, everyone. Wash your hands. And see you in 2 weeks.